Drive. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And my name is Dick. As we've done for 33 or so years, 34 years, maybe 35. Starting in 1982 in September, the TechNet meets every Sunday night for 4 hours from 8 o'clock until midnight. And it's a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, transmitters, receivers, and antennas. And the 34 or so, 35, 27 different kinds of ham radio. 2 meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the many kinds. Quadruple, this is one of the most educational hobbies there is. It allows you to meet people in many places in the world on an even footing, even though they might be way above you or way below you in economics or power or whatever. Let me drop it. The technical net, its main purpose is education. There is a website by which you can listen to the past tech nets, 10 or 11 years worth of them, are at amateurradio.tangovictor. A website that's run by my KC2NJI. And there's another supporting website that backs up the TechNet by Mike number 2, K1MJM. That's TechNetLimeOck.com. So each of those websites have past articles. And in the case of the first one, amateurradio.tangovictor, you can choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and listen to past TechNet. Some of the ones for the first few years were even cross-referenced to what subject was being discussed every 10 minutes. Mike got very busy, and the later recordings don't have the cross-referencing. We dropped. This will be TechNet number 1654 of that series that began in September of 1982. Later on tonight, you'll also be hearing the space report, couldn't even think of the words all of a sudden, of Paul, WS2N. That would be space report number 254. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or comment by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes. That means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. We used to have a great big long list. Let me drop it. Great big long list of people who told us they're listening. After 35 or so years, 34 and a half years, by now we believe somebody is listening. Particularly since this machine is hooked up with Echolink and IRLP, so there are people quite often listening from other states and other countries, and sometimes they sign in, particularly the guys in the Golden Horseshoe area near Toronto, Canada, will sometimes sign in with some doctored questions. Let me drop. So if you do have a question or a comment, now's the time to sign in. Please give me your call letters and your name, and try to remember to listen to the four beeps in between each transmission. K2L, I should be listening.
To exchange.
Okay, the first sign in was Rich.
Yes, Rich, yes.
Okay, we've got Wes and Rich so far. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes. What a comment.
Okay, we've got Joe. Wes, Rich, and Joe so far. Got a call? Anybody want to sign in for the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters right now.
WS2N, Paul with the space report, and also a comment, put in that back.
Okay, Paul with a real double sign in, because he's got a comment for the net also. One last call. Anyone who's got a question or a comment, please give me the call letters and name right now. K2LIW. We've got more than enough to get started. So number one on the runway is Wes, N2XJN. how those RF electrons in Queens County treating you tonight, Wes. And direct JN, teacher I, the Unitech Net.
I assume you were referring to particle physics. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean it. I was today for probably 15 minutes, 20 minutes on the Hampers in Queens, and I've got for $2, yeah, $2, 5 inches, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah, 5 inches by 3 inches. It looks like directional copper, but it does have two inputs and connectors. It does have on the right-hand side connector that is called load, and from the left-hand side it is called antenna. It is made by Microwave Associates, but actually it is made by the parent company Macom, M-A-C-O-M. Let me drop. It's a quite big device. Thickness is around 1 inch. Yeah, a little bit less than 1 inch. So, inch by 5 inches by 3 inches. Four connectors, end connectors, and two of them are inputs. Left-hand side is antenna, right-hand side is load. And I'm trying to find out what exactly it is. If it was just a simple directional coupler, then we wouldn't have additional load. So it looks like a comparator. I just am confused. Enter it here.
Okay. Over the years, I've dealt a lot with a company called Microwave Associates. I'm very familiar with a company called ACOM, which is what became the parent company for Microwave Associates. And from the physical description of what you've given me, it sounds very much, since you didn't tell me it's got a coupling capacitor by which you put close to 15 volts into it, sounds like a thoroughly tested device. The dimensions you've given to me sound very much like a directional coupler. Most directional couplers have a total of 3 connectors. Call it an input connector, an output connector, and a coupling line connector, the one that gives you a signal that's 10 or 20 dB down for the signal to flow in a particular direction. The directional line inside, the directional coupling line, let me drop, usually has an internal 50 ohm termination that you do not see, in which case you would have a total of 3 connectors. Maybe these are type N connectors. You said you've got 4 connectors, which means it's either a dual directional coupler, and there's a pair of couplers in there, and a pair of dummy loads. More likely, it is a directional coupler where you supply the termination for the coupling line. That would be the 4th connector. So you told me the 2 connectors on one side, and one of them's called antenna, and one connector on the far side, one of them is called load. You said there's a 4th connector. You didn't tell me where it's located. Enter XJN, K2I, W, go ahead, Wes. Go ahead, Eric.
I could be wrong, but from the description that Wes said, you know how well I hear him. He's got 2 antenna connectors. It sounds like, and MACOM makes them, 2 inputs, an output, and a load. It's a combiner with circulator. It's small, but depends on the frequency gain. But I've seen plenty of those.
Okay, let me give you an additional explanation. So, that flat box is lying on a table. Right next to me, I have on the thin part, I have 2 inputs, just 2 inputs and connectors. On the right hand side, so that's 5 inches long. Nothing on the top, everything is on the side. On the right hand side, I have an end connector called load. And on the left hand side, but upper corner of the left-hand side, also on the side, I have a connector called antenna. The label on it says Microwave Associates, Macom Company, which actually did, I assume it was after 2001 when both of the companies were, no, 1990 when both of the companies joined. The model number that is on the sticker from Microwave Associates, which is Microwave Associates A Macom Company, so Micro Company is the parent company, this H4105, but the printed model on the box, along with other printed, like antenna input and load, the TDE 6248, TDE, time domain E, whatever. It looks like it is made for the antenna, so it is a direction coupler, but what the load is for, you say the load is external on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, we have antenna. Right-hand side, we have load. From the bottom, we have, from the side, actually, we have two inputs. Go ahead.
Okay. The left-hand side has the two inputs.
It's bottom, so it's lying on a table. From my side, the side, the thin side from my side is two inputs. On the right-hand side is load, on the left-hand side is antenna.
Okay. One of the inputs is called antenna, one of the outputs is called load. There's a third connector. What's the label on the third connector?
Okay. Two of the connectors from my side are called input. I-N-P-U-T. Two of them. The one on the right-hand side is called load. And the one on the left-hand side is called antenna.
Okay. Do some of the input connectors have a label of antenna? There seems to be two input connectors. Is one of them labeled antenna?
Correct. The one on the left-hand side is labeled antenna. The one from the opposite side, which is the 3 inches side, right? So it's called antenna. The one from the opposite side from the antenna is called load. And I have two inputs from the bottom called inputs.
The physical dimensions that you say, 5 inches long, 3 inches wide, 1 inch thick, with no circular object and no obvious magnets anywhere. Therefore, it is very unlikely to be a circulator, as Eric was describing to us. A circulator requires literally a circular object somewhere inside with magnets on the upper and lower surface, and I'm not hearing any evidence of those magnets. Is this thing a blue case with a red label on it? Go ahead.
No, it's a gold and silver color, more like a silver color. And only one label, plastic label on it. Actually, it's not plastic, it's aluminum label on it. It says Microwave Associates, a Macom company. So yes, we have one connector, end connector, a load, called load, exactly. We have one antenna and two inputs.
Yeah, from the physical description, I would bet my money on a directional coupler, and you can prove it. By putting your signal generator on the antenna port, by putting a 50-ohm dummy load on the so-called load port, and then putting your energy sensor, whether it be a spec repeater,
timeout.
By putting your semi-meter
code. I have the vector network analyzer, two of them.
By putting your energy sensing device on the third port, you could confirm whether or not it's a directional coupler. If it was a directional coupler, it might be 10 or 20 dB of directional coupling. In other words, you put a 0 dBm signal into the antenna port, a 50-ohm dummy load on the load port, and the third port, you might see a signal of minus 10 or minus 20 dB if it was a directional coupler. And by reversing the antenna and load In other words, just disconnecting those, flipping the device upside down, and reconnecting it, and leaving the sensing port right where it is. If you see a difference in the amount of coupling, if you saw 10 dB of, minus 10 dB of coupling in one direction and minus 30 in the other, it would be a very strong piece of evidence that it's a directional coupler. If it's some kind of a summing device where it takes two inputs and sums them to the one output, there's ways you can check that also. But by way of your vector network analyzer, sweeping it while looking at the energy coming out of the third port, you'll confirm very rapidly whether or not it is a directional coupler. If you opened up the case, I could tell you what a directional coupler would look like. Let me drop it. It would be a kind of tri-plate stripped line. The upper flat surface and the lower flat surfaces would be the outer dimension of the coaxial structure. The center conductor will be a piece of wide, you know, a half-inch wide piece of silver-plated metal going from one of the input ports to the load port. And then there'll be a parallel, similar device, a fraction of an inch away, that's the coupling line. That's what you would see on the input. And loosening those screws and opening the case is not destructive if you choose to do that. But there's a lot of measurements you can make from the outside. You can also confirm with your ohmmeter. If you measure 0 ohms between the antenna port and the load port, center conductor, that would be a strong piece of evidence that it's a directional coupler. And if you measure from center conductor of input number one to center conductor of input number two, if you measure an open circuit, again, that would be a strong piece of evidence that's a directional coupler. So by ohmmeter checks first, and network analyzer or signal generator and spectrum analyzer or power meter tests, you'll eventually find out what it is by... And by the way, the length being 5 inches long, it sounds to me like it's mid-VHF region. In other words, numbers like 500 megacycles is probably the frequency region where it's rated west. Into XJN, you've got some homework to do, some testing, which is all non-destructive, by the way. K2LIW in the TechNet.
And the reason that N connectors were used, I mean, the N connectors were used, but do you...
You said end connectors were used. I think there's a question in there. I don't have the question yet, Fred.
Yes, what is the reason that this thing has end connectors? Probably because of the frequency being so low?
An end connector, depending on the exact model number, can work from zero, literally zero, to 12 gigahertz at least, and if it's a precision one, 0 to 18 gigahertz. I don't call that low frequency. A N connector is a very precision connector, good to at least 12 and maybe 18 gigahertz. Over to US, K2LIW.
And that makes me ask another question, why your Baca decided to go for APC7 instead of N connectors. Actually, they had some of the vector network analyzers that were using N connectors as well, but actually the one that I have, this one goes probably to 24 gigahertz. Don't see the model number, but anyhow. Okay, now, what is the reason for two inputs on the directional coupler?
It could be something funny with the labeling. One of those could be a real input, and by way of measuring center conductor from an input connector to center conductor of load connector, if center conductor to center conductor on your ohmmeter measures 0 ohms, that is the straight through line. That's the main signal path line, and the other connector is sampling some of that signal by way of the directional coupling function. And by way of your ohmmeter showing that the center conductor of the second conductor is not connected to the first two that I mentioned, that would be a further confirmation. Type N connectors are a precision connector, good to very high frequencies. Well-made equipment uses type N connectors. Cheaper equipment uses UHF and RCA phono plug, other kinds of PNCs and so on. So the physical dimension leads me to believe it's likely to be a directional coupler. By way of the measurements you're about to make, you'll find out pretty fast.
If you send a picture of it to me, it might help me also recognize the package, even though it's relabeled. I might be able to recognize the physical layout. Also, will give me a hint of where. Into XJN, K2RIW.
Hey, JJ.
Go ahead, Eric.
Add a couple of things. Generally, especially as you get into the higher frequencies, hand connectors are capable of handling a lot of power all at the same time. I will show you the next time I see you. A rectangular box, it's a little bit bigger than what he's describing, but within that rectangular box will be actually a circulator. But get beyond that, the case doesn't have to be round, is my point in that. And the other thing is, they tend to make transmitters. And two inputs, an output that goes to an antenna and a load, typically is what I do in my transmitters, bigger, of course, but there will be some divider or coupling, whichever way you want to be. But it truly sounds like that piece of transmitting gear, and putting two amplifiers together to make an output. It's RIWK3J. By the way, they do make a lot of different kinds of transmitting.
Yeah, the next guess, if it's not a directional coupler, it could be a Wilkinson power divider, power summer, a two input, one output is one possibility. That device, from your description, Wes, when it was brand new, it was a couple when it was brand new, it was a couple of $1,000. For you to buy it for $2, you definitely got your money's worth. So when you get a chance, mail me a picture of that. Even tonight, then I might be able to make a pronouncement. N2XJN, wait for the beeps, K2RIW.
RIW, K6DBZ is here if I could be of any tech.
Okay, yes. The last question that I have for it, and you can go to another guy, is what is the reason for external load instead of internal FTL? N2XJN.
Explain to him what Robinson divided and he'll understand the answer.
If the device happens to be a Wilkinson hybrid, which is a 2-to-1 power divider, or if you use it backwards, a 2-to-1 summer, the output, they call it the load output, and the two inputs, literally are the two inputs. Type N connectors can take up to 1,000 watts, probably close to 1,000 megacycles of continuous power, if the center conductor is in real good shape, doesn't have a all the silver plating scraped away because it's been inserted 1,000 times into something. So type N connectors, good to either 12 or 18 gigahertz, good to close to 1,000 watts, and so very handy. The word load doesn't mean you actually have to put a 50 ohm dummy load there. The word load could really mean the output, so to speak, if it was a power summer. So mail me a picture, and you got your money's worth on that one. If the guy had three of them, you should have bought all three. Was there more than one of those there, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Why don't you tell how you check those things if they...
It was only one of them. I would buy all of them. I mean, I have a collection of it, but this one is kind of unique. N2XJN.
Okay, tell their company check.
Okay, very fine, Wes. The next guy on our list was Rich, K2UPS. K2UPS? Where are you located? What direction are you traveling? What's the weather like? Go right ahead with your question or comment, Rich. I, awful nice hearing you from time to time. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2UPS Mobile. Good evening, Dick. Well, I'm eastbound, right on the Ohio, West Virginia border. And it's still nice and sunny here at about 83 degrees. I just had some information or a comment for you about something that's going to happen between 9:04 and 9:19 tonight. But I have a feeling since Paul checked in with a comment, he may want to tell you about that, and would probably have more information on it. So if Paul is going to talk, his comment was about something that's happening tonight after 9 o'clock, I'll let him tell you. Back to that.
That's good information, Rich. I'm going to flip over to Paul right now. WS2N, is there a major spatial event tonight, which maybe you mentioned to us last week, and I'm so forgetful. So go right ahead, Paul. WS2N, with a mini space report, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Paul.
Yeah, this is WS2N. Yeah, well,
it was, it's the launch from Wallops. It's, I guess you consider an experiment, a carrier rocket, sounding rocket, so it doesn't go into orbit, but it goes, you know, a couple hundred miles high. And after, you know, after 4 minutes after launch, it's going to release a canister, and you're going to get different colors, red, green, and blue, coming out of it, creating a cloud. So that cloud possibly could be seen, they said, from New York all the way down to the Carolinas. They have two stations that are going to be observing this one, actually in South Carolina, and another one, you know, up north in Virginia. So, yeah, that happens at 9:04. Now, the window opens up, as, you know, today's the first day, and it's going to go off. The window stays open for like 18 days, so if there's bad weather or problems, it could be delayed, you know, night after night. But tonight would be the first night to observe it, and they're going to have it on YouTube and all, so that's really the, you know, one announcement. I had another announcement, but, yeah, let me do that while I'm doing this. Let me drop it.
By the way, Paul, I think the quickest way to find out if the launch is going to take place tonight, you're going to give us a website address that we go to, tells us they're doing a countdown, and if they do a launch at our dusk, I imagine if we look to our southeast at our horizon, if we're at a big enough field where we've got a clear shot of the horizon, like in a schoolyard or something like that, without local trees, my guess is we might actually see the rocket flame itself. So, there's probably a website will let us know, are they doing a countdown, and should we run out there to see the takeoff tonight?
Repeater, time out.
So back to you for that information, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, into the beeps.
You won't see the rocket, you know, the engine, but you could see the cloud that it releases up in the ionosphere, and then they'll watch this cloud drift. They want to see how it drifts in the ionosphere. And, you know, you can go to NASA, Wallops Island, sounding rocket, maybe put today's date, Google it should come up, you know, put a Ustream, going to do a Ustream. And maybe Rich has the exact, I know it was a pretty long website, URL. I didn't shorten it. Maybe he has it. So, yeah, that's one thing. And the other thing I was going to mention, not related to this, is because I wanted to mention it early, because sometimes we lose a lot of people as it gets later. On the ClubNet tomorrow night, or the Info ClubNet, you know, there's always the ClubNet, and then followed by Stop and Shop, Swap and Shop, and then finally, after that, they have Newsline. And it turns out that the contact that was made out here in Ronkonkoma, the story of that contact will be on Newsline Monday night. That usually comes on around 9 o'clock. It'll be the second story in. They have a half a dozen stories. You know how the Newsline goes. So it's the second one. My daughter's voice is on there. And they're interviewing her and all. So, back to you, this is WS2N. Yeah, back to you.
The launch window is between 9:04 and 9:19.
9:04 and 9:19 tonight. Are they doing a countdown when you went to that website, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW, is there a likely launch tonight?
No, I went to the Wallops Island launch schedule, and if you switch over to NASA TV, which I'm doing now, they'll probably have something about it there. Actually, I should go inside. I've actually got NASA off the satellite, and I can see what's happening. And by the way, I've got a comment about the letter when we get to it.
Very fine. And you're on my list, so we're going to be getting... Well, no, you're not on my list. So I'm going to put you on my list. Okay. When it comes to the news line, where your daughter is mentioned because of the International Space Station CUSO that they had, and your daughter is an employee of that school, also a ham radio operator, and I think she has your same last name, but there I'm not sure. I think there is a YouTube website that we can go to that will allow us to go directly to Newsline. Is that the possible form? WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet.
You know, I can play it for you after we're finished tonight.
Okay, that's an offer beyond midnight, so to speak, but let's see what the Paul has to say. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I've heard it through the computer. You can go bring up Newsline, you can bring up number 2067, that's the last one. That's what they were up to, so. Actually, it'll be the first one that shows up because you're bringing it up right away. And, of course, old habits die hard. I'll be listening over the air on Monday. I always listen after the net. And that's just the way it is, you know. But, yeah, I've heard it already. It's very, very good. And they did a very, you know, this guy, got his call letter. I wrote it down, but I don't have it handy. Paul Brown does a very good interview. These guys have a terrific voice. Back to you there, Dick, WS.
Okay, Paul, thank you for that information. Let me check now back with Rich to make sure we got the whole message that he was giving to us. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, on the West Virginia-Pennsylvania border, K2LAW, heading east. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, K2UPS Mobile. Yeah, I had gotten an alert on my cell phone about it, I think from space.com, but I just wanted to alert the members about it. But then when Paul checked in, I figured he would do the same thing. So, and I wasn't sure if it was mentioned last week. We'll see. So that's it from the Sendek, K2UPS back to net.
Very fine, Rich. Thank you for signing in, and keep doing that. The next person with a comment, of course, is going to be very brief. I'm having fun with Joe. Joe gives us some nice long conversations from time to time. K2, here we go. W2OYY. K2IZ. You got it, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. Well, it shouldn't take too long. There's actually a comment on a program I watched on one of PBS channels. It was about solar systems. It was on Ask This Old House. Previewed a couple of days ago, and they talked about photovoltaic systems, especially in Hawaii, where they have apparently a lot of sunlight the good part of the year. And they talked about a system that uses 12 photovoltaic panels, and it's an energy storage system because the local utility companies don't want you feeding power back into the grid anymore. Apparently out there, so I have some sort of stipulation about that. So what they want you to do is, it generates power for your house in the daytime, and I guess it also stores power in these batteries so it can, feed your electric back to you when the sun starts going down. The company name of this, I don't know if this is solar cells or just the inverter battery units. It's called Enphase, E-N-P-H-A-S-E, break. Interesting part about it was the batteries are, they hang on a wall on these rack-mounted units that, I guess the actual rack-mounted unit, it goes on the wall mount, the unit, I should say, goes on a wall. These batteries basically hang up on this thing. You can, take them anywhere about 50 pounds or so, you put them up on this system. Each battery is capable of delivering 1.2 kilowatts. In this particular application, they used 5 units on a wall, wall-mounted units. And the funny thing about it was they only used number 12 conductor wire between the wall-mount units. The other thing I saw them demonstrate is that the system is monitorable via a smartphone. Back to you.
Depending on how many solar voltaic cells are in series determines whether or not the system is made to produce 6 volts, 12 volts, 24, 48, 309, whatever. What's your guess as to the voltage coming out of the array of photovoltaics that goes into the battery assembly wired with 12 gauge wire? Any idea what voltage they're running now? Joe, WYY, K2LAW.
Which big solar panels run between 34 and 48 volts?
They did not say that, but they did say that the photovoltaic units have microinverters on them, so they're not wiring the series. So if you lose a photovoltaic unit on your roof, they must be wired, I guess, in a parallel combination, where if you lose one or two, the whole system doesn't go down like the earlier systems that were wired in series. You lose everything. The wired in a string or something like that. That's what they, you know, have to say. Again, 12 photovoltaic units. They didn't come out with a name of what those panels are. Maybe it's made by the same system or not. But I just wanted to bring this up because you like talking about this stuff from time to time. And what else did you ask me about the thing? They only said the 12-gauge wire was between the conductors going between the wall units. They didn't specify the wiring size coming down from these microinverters on the roof units.
The wall units, are they generating by way of the inverters 60 cycles, quasi sine wave, 120 volts RMS? Is that what you believe? That's question number one. And the batteries themselves, any idea what kind of batteries we're talking about? Lead acid, lithium ion, or whatever? Are you a joke?
No, didn't specify that at all. The battery unit was something this guy picked up. He said they weigh about 50 pounds. I guess you got to make sure you mount these wall units to your wall fairly secure. But he just lifted one up, put it on the wall mode, wall unit, locked it in place, and that was that. The other thing they said was it only uses 12 gauge wire between wall units. I guess, it looked like just plus minus. It just two conductors between the wall units. Apparently, it must be some sort of power summing system that went to some sort of energy management system located elsewhere that would look like it was near the breaker panel. The whole clip ran about maybe 6 to 7 minutes. It wasn't a very long clip, but I guess you could probably find that particular program if you look on the back episodes of This Old House, Ask This Old House. And it was the first part of it is on woodworking, but the whole thing takes place out in Hawaii.
It's a little bit disappointing that Hawaii has now set some rules that you can't pump power back into their grid. I'm a little disappointed to hear that. When they say the system can produce a kilowatt, now there's three different power/energy ratings that I care about. Number one, at what rate can you charge those batteries? Maybe the answer is a kilowatt. At what rate can the batteries through the inverter deliver power back into your house? Maybe that's a kilowatt. And the third thing you want to know about is how many kilowatt hours? What's the total energy output? Can it give you a kilowatt for an hour? Can it give you a kilowatt for 3 hours? That third number, most news reports don't give that to you. They just say, the batteries will deliver a kilowatt. Well, can it deliver a kilowatt for 10 minutes or 10 hours? That's a big difference as far as running my house on is concerned. My guess is because that particular number, the most important number, is watt hours of total energy output, joules of energy output, because that number is so often dropped, maybe it wasn't even indicated in this article, Joe, to B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The guy only mentioned the battery units were 1.2 kilowatt units. Each battery unit, they chose to use five of them. He did not mention about kilowatt hours over length of time, amp hour draw out of these battery units, or charging current that the battery units draw off your solar system. But he did demonstrate at the end of the whole clip that you can monitor a smartphone, so it must have some sort of Wi-Fi output or something like that, that you can look at with a smartphone app, and it can see when you're drawing power from the electrical grid, you're drawing power from your solar cells, and producing power apparently from these battery units. So if you want more information, I guess you'd probably have to look at the thing directly or go to that company I mentioned, Enphase, E-N-P-H-A-S-E, and see if there's more information. I'm going to look at it myself and go on the web later on, see if I can find any more information about it. But they didn't specify a lot of technical details people like you and I would like to know. They didn't really specify that.
Yeah, we're going to be seeing more and more renewable energy systems. Wind and solar voltaic are the two biggies. And some of them are hydroelectric, tide, water currents, geothermal. There's a lot of ways we can get that renewable energy quasi free of charge, if you know what I mean, not counting the hardware required to capture that energy. There was a couple of articles this week about China, I think, is now setting up solar voltaic farms on a lake. In other words, a man-made lake has a whole bunch of these floating multi-square meter panels all wired together for a solar voltaic system. So that's an interesting way to go. Thank you for that information, Joe, and let's keep us up to date on that one. Sounds like Eric has got some kind of a question, and any major changes in the last week or so with what our new television system is about to become, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I just went to Elfo's website, as they fondly call it in Hawaii. They have a whole segment about solar and storage. They talk about batteries, although I didn't dive into it. Anyway, I wanted to make mention of that letter that you that went to the ARRL about connectors in line, and it just brought an interesting thought to me because I had to sweep my line, talk about changing antennas, channels rather. The length of the segments of my coax, because there's bullets and flanges, the length of those segments, okay, you can think of each one of them as sort of like a PL-259 connected to an SO-239 connected to a PL-259. And how it affects the VISLAW depending upon the wavelengths of what you're feeding through it. And I just thought it was an interesting thing because in that article, nobody mentioned anything about possible reflections from putting those devices in the line. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, what we're referring to now is the June issue of QST Magazine. The article, the monthly column called The Doctor Is In, the very first article there, is a ham radio operator is using three connectors in order to do a splice in the middle of a coax cable somewhere. He's using a pair of PL-259 with a PL-258. The 258 is the double female, and the PL-259s are the double are the single males that go into each of the cables. That assembly of PL-259, SO-238, or maybe it's PL-238, and PL-259, that combination electronically is 1.78 inches long, according to Joel Hallis, the guy who writes that article. And so now, and by the way, if you take apart, as I have, if you take apart the 238 device, the double female UHF connector, inside you'll see certain dimensions of outer diameter and inner diameter, and a piece of polystyrene that holds it all together with one brand name, and pieces of Teflon with the other. When you study dimensions and dielectric constants and the whole works, the connector appears to have a 30 ohm characteristic impedance, and quite possibly the PL-259 itself is a 30 ohm. I used to estimate it as 35 ohm, and now begin to think it as a 30 ohm connector. Let me drop. Now, most of us would think it's a horrible thing to do to take a length of line 1.78 inches long with a characteristic impedance of 30 ohms and put it somewhere in the middle of a 50 ohm coaxial cable. At first it sounds like a terrible thing to do. Far from it. It's a very intelligent thing to do most of the time. As you go to higher frequencies, at 80 meters, that connector combination, you would never know it's there unless you did a very careful measurement with a time domain reflectometer. When you get up to a frequency as high as 432, your 1.78 inches of 30 ohm connector assembly with a velocity factor of 69% has the electrical equivalent of 34 degrees, that 360 degrees is a wavelength, 34 degrees of length of cable. So if I put 34 degrees of cable, 1.78 inches physical length. At 432 in my 50-ohm coax, it makes a predictable amount of change in input impedance at that connector assembly. 50 ohms is the output low, the connector assembly, and you're looking at the input. And you see something like, I vaguely remember, is 38 ohms resistive and 70 ohms reactive, capacitor reactant. It's a very predictable amount of input impedance you get from 34 degrees of 30 ohm transmission line. Now, at first you'd say that's going to create 0.78 dB of extra insertion loss. Let me drop. There's a yes and a no to that. When it comes to the feed through power, if you had a 50 ohm source into that connector assembly, followed by a 50 ohm cable into a 50 ohm load, and you measured it without that connector assembly versus adding that connector assembly, the throughput power goes down by 0.78 decibels. 0.78 decibels is a 12th of an S unit. The average guy you're talking to is not going to know the difference. If you're a serious 432 operator like a moan bouncer, 0.78 dB is beyond the threshold of alarm. You're going to try to want to do something about it. The 0.78 dB of apparent loss is because of standing wave ratio and a certain reflection coefficient. A little bit less than 10% of the power, 12% of the power, or 9% of the power is being reflected. The reflected power is not lost. If you're smart enough to put the right kind of an impedance matching device there, all of that reflected power will get re-reflected forward. If you put that connector assembly right at the output of your antenna tuner in the shack, and then you allow the antenna tuner, an automatic antenna tuner, to do its thing, there would be 0 dB of insertion loss. The main point that I was making that was missed in the article, let me drop, is that Joel Harris said that that connector assembly on a 50-ohm line, he was using a LMR 400, as I remember, a good line for 432. At 432, he says that that connector assembly is going to create 0.78 dB of loss. I say absolutely not. Only 0.78 dB of loss if you put that connector assembly at the antenna, at the far end of the 100 feet of cable. No informed UHF antenna, UHF operator would do that. You wouldn't be using a splicing device right at the antenna. As you move that splicing device along the line closer and closer to the shack, right at the shack at the antenna tuner output, gives you no loss at all. So you're getting a certain amount of double reflective power between the connector assembly and your antenna tuner. Power is back and forth, bouncing back and forth in some length of line, depending on where you put the splice. So Joel's 0.78 dB is the worst possible case loss of putting that connector assembly at the antenna. Nobody would do that. And so I tried to make that point. I wrote two separate letters to ARL on that. And then I got a reply, thank you for your comments. The main point I was making is that the loss for the average case is not going to be anywhere near that high. Let me drop this. On top of that, there's a huge educational problem that can be propagated here. There's a lot of education if he digs a little bit deeper into it. Yeah, standing wave ratio is something that the average ham is scared of. They know it's bad. They're afraid of it. The average ham and many technologists, and apparently even all of the people at ARRL headquarters, believes that a standing wave ratio anywhere along the length of a transmission line gives you the same detriment as if it is along the whole length of the line. Absolutely not. If I put that 1 foot away from the antenna tuner, there's only 1 foot of cable that has some extra power bouncing back and forth and some extra insertion loss. What the main piece of information with reference to standing wave ratio that is not properly given at any of our books, in any of our courses, is that whenever you launch a signal into a transmission medium, it could be a light signal in air, it could be a radio signal in air, it could be a radio signal in a transmission line, it could be an audio signal in air, or an audio signal in a piece of cable. Anytime you launch a signal into some kind of a transmission medium, that signal is looking at the characteristic impedance of the medium, the 377 ohms of free space, or the 50 ohms of your cable. If the characteristic impedance never changes, the signal will travel along that medium with absolutely no restriction. If there's the slightest change in impedance, higher, lower, reactive, whatever, if there's any change in the characteristic impedance of the medium, like the light wave hits the glass of the front of a store window, when there's ever a change in the medium's characteristic impedance, there will be a calculable amount of reflected energy at that interface where the change in impedance takes place. That's the main...
Repeater, time out.
That's the main thing that causes standing wave ratio, a change in the characteristic impedance. The change in the characteristic impedance could be that your antenna, the load at the end, is 100 ohms instead of 50 ohms. That's a change in the impedance. Or you've decided to splice two pieces of cable together. You started off with 50 ohm cable and you've spliced the 75 ohm cable for the rest. That's a change in the characteristic impedance. Whenever there's a change in the impedance, you get a calculatable amount of reflected energy at that interface. You can trace that by way of a Smith chart. You can trace it by way of an equation. You can just simply calculate the standing wave ratio. In the case of a 70 ohm cable and a 50 ohm cable, you divide 50 into 75, you end up with a 1.3 standing wave ratio. And how much reflected energy you get from a 1.3, and how much change you get in throughput energy. You can look that up in all kinds of charts. So the main thing that the average guy scared to death of standing wave ratio doesn't know about is that standing wave ratio is created by something that's creating a reflection, and the only thing that'll create a reflection is a change in the characteristic impedance. That very basic truth, important piece of information is never given to the average ham. He's given a lousy introduction to what standing wave ratio is. He's given it as a whole bunch of equations and a crazy theory given by the physics department that's very difficult to understand, and the average guy is afraid of it. And I'm trying to change that. It is not rocket science. KE2EJ, K2REJ. Go right ahead with your further comments on all of the above, Eric.
K2REW, K2EJ. Well, my case is sort of special in terms of that I have pieces of pipe, six and an eighth inch diameter coax, and they're flanges at the ends of each one of these segments that go off the tower. Now, when you look at it with a TDR and you filter all the gunk out, you see exactly the distance of the flanges and where they are, and the actual amount of reflected energy from each one of those flanges. And in my case, because the length of those segments of cable are critical. Now, if you want to think about how to produce the least amount of reflected energy in each one of those busts where the flanges come together and the bullet that fits in between them, is a predictable length in which you can minimize that. And in essence, what you're really wanting is for the zero crossing, so to speak, to pass through those bullets, if you want to look at it in a very simplistic point of view. Now, let me let it drop. In my real world example, the length of my pieces of segment is 90.8 inches, which is precisely right, the channel 21. And the reflection coefficients that I get at each one of those joints tends to be in the order of 1 to 1.02. 0.03, but at channel 32, where I'm going to be moving, the reflection coefficients come back at 1.5, 1 to 1.6, which for most broadcasters, or at least in the digital realm, is completely unacceptable, because now we start to get matching symbols together. But that article and what I was experiencing, you can correlate the two things, and I found it to be incredibly interesting.
Now, you gave us some nice information, but one piece of data was missing there, Eric. If I take, for instance, my particular case of the 30-ohm transmission line system, which is an assembly of PL259 SO238 connectors, 1.78 inches long, if that 30-ohm chunk of line in the middle of a 50-ohm cable happens to be exactly a half wavelength or a multiple of a half wavelength long, you don't see it at that frequency. Any piece of mismatched cable, the wrong impedance, which is a multiple of a half wavelength, the magic of a half wavelength of cable is that whatever load you put on the output, the get the exact same load on the input if the cable is a half wavelength long. Put 31.5 ohms on the load. At the input, you'll see 31.5 ohms of that piece of 30-ohm cable that's a half wavelength long. So if your bullets happen to be a multiple of a half wavelength at your operating frequency, no matter what their impedance is, as long as it's a constant impedance along their length, it washes out. That's if you have just one bullet in the system. And now if you have multiple bullets, and if each of the bullets is the right length and the right kind of spacings between them, all kinds of desirable things can happen. Although in your case, you'd rather not have reflections between the bullets, because that, let me drop the time delays of those echoes through a length of cable can give you ghosting back in the old days of analog television, and can give you inter-symbol distortion in the modern-day digital television. So you'd rather not have multiple reflections through many wavelengths of line. But each individual bullet, if it happens to be a half wavelength long and your operating frequency is beautiful, your new frequency is no longer a half wavelength long, and maybe there's a company that'll sell you the right length of bullet, or maybe you're going to have to use your hacksaw in your bullet to make it a little bit shorter if your frequency is going up, Eric. I'm joking with you here a little bit, although there's a way of doing beautiful compensations with this. I'll get on the next transmission. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
I've sent you the pictures, Dick.
Thank you. Go ahead, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, it's really a bit more complicated than that, but we also have elbows. By the way, a line length is about 400, a little over 400 feet, and 6 1/8 inch coax, you know, hard line. And the natural impedance of the hard line that we use to go up to the antenna, the antenna actually happens to be 75 ohms, and of course the feed line is 75 ohms. So, actually, if you looked at the chart for the various lengths of segments and what channel, what frequencies they work best at, actually at the channel 32, the number should be 90.27 inches as opposed to 90.8 inches, what we're using at channel 21, so there's a difference. When you finally sum them all together and you have them the right length, the impedance at the input looks exactly like the impedance at the output. K2RIW, K2K.
Because you're now going to a new frequency where the lengths are no longer right, is there a way you can you can change the length of those bullets to be tuned to your particular operating frequency? Eric, go ahead.
Well, if you've ever seen the way the bullets are constructed, it's a hunk of Teflon. It sits on the inside diameter of the center conductor, and they're basically a fixed length, and the spacing is fixed in terms of how they butt together. That came about many, many years ago to, you know, standardize what you make your transmission line for high-powered gear. The resultant, because the government's going to be paying for this, we're essentially going to have two antennas on a tower. We're going to change the transmission line and the antenna on one. And then once that's together and working, then we'll do that to the other one. The reality is there are tuners, little stub tuners for the corners to the elbows to try and smooth things out. Because as you know, if you make that 90 degree turn, it gets a little bumpy along the way.
Whenever you have a coaxial system that has a bend, an elbow, a flange, a coupling, no matter what, if physically the center conductor and the outer conductor have a slight change in diameter, and if the dielectric material supporting it has a slight change in the dielectric constant, velocity factor, and so on. Any change in the characteristic impedance is going to give you a reflection. The reflection, though, is tunable. There's all kinds of ways you could add a tuning stub, tuning screws, and whatever. What the ham radio operators do in a case like this is they take a steel BB, put it in the middle of the coax cable with a magnet on the outside, moving the magnet along, they're moving the BB. They find the desirable location where they get the beginning of a correction, where they're looking at the standing wave ratio, or they're looking at the reflection on a time domain reflector. Usually they're looking at standing wave ratio. They find the right location with the BB as to where an improvement in standing wave ratio occurs. Then they put a tuning screw in that area and then repeat the process and put a second BB. And they're slowly building a double-step tuner by putting two